Veterans Day happens every year on November the 11th. It commemorates the armistice that ended the fighting in World War I on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. Just a reminder to you, Memorial Day is at the end of May. And in Memorial Day, we remember those who gave the last full measure of their devotion. They took up the uniform of our country and they went in service and they did not return. Veterans Day is not that. Veterans Day is the day we remember those who put on the uniform of our country knowing that they might be asked to give the last full measure of their devotion, but they've come home. I was writing the sermon on Veterans Day, and kind of channel surfing and looking for some background noise, and the History Channel had a Band of Brothers marathon on, and if Band of Brothers is on, we just leave it on in our house. If you've not watched it, you should. It's about Easy Company, the 2nd Battalion, the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne, a unit formed in World War II who fought from D-Day in Normandy to victory in Europe. And it tells their story. They began at Camp Toccoa in Georgia, just a group of men who've been assembled from across the country, being taught to do one of the most difficult things that anyone's ever done. Why don't you jump out of a perfectly functioning aircraft to land in a place where you haven't been before to fight an entrenched enemy? And it takes some experience to get that ready. Part of that experience is running up Mount Currahee. 3 miles up, 3 miles down became their motto. Running up and down Mount Currahee was something they did together as a regiment to get in physically better shape. It is also a punishment that was inflicted upon people. If you made a mistake, someone might just order you, run Currahee. And you've got this much time to get 3 miles up and 3 miles down, and there were moments at long days when you knew all you had to do was quit. And they would let you leave. You'd look up at Mount Currahee, and then a couple of other guys from the regiment would come and pat you on the back and say, "Let's go." And they'd run the mountain that they did not have to run with you because you did have to run it. They parachuted behind enemy lines in Normandy. They fought in the battle to regain a foothold in Europe. And when the battle was over, they flew back to England to regroup, to see what their numbers were. The last scene of that episode, by the way, finds a new sergeant going into the laundry to pick up his uniforms that have been cleaned. And the laundress says, "Hey, as long as you're here, I have these packages." And they have names on them of those who have given the last full measure of their devotion, and they're not coming home. And he just reaches in his pocket and takes out British money that no one seems to be able to make sense of and says, what do you need? They continued to fight. They liberated a part of Dachau and saw the worst that humans can do to each other. They made it all the way to Berchtesgaden, Hitler's summer paradise. They were the soldiers that took his house away. And they stood on those mountain peaks and looked out at the world together and had a sense that they were making something for the rest of time. What happened was, through their shared suffering and sacrifice and experience, this disparate group of men from all across the country were forged into a family. And Stephen Ambrose's book that tells their story takes its title, Band of Brothers, from William Shakespeare's play Henry V, the fourth act, the third scene, 5-4-3, you can remember. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today who sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. There's a truth in that. And power in that. It's how we become family to one another. I tell you that because we've been listening to Paul's letter to the Galatians, and all through the letter, what Paul has been saying is the one true and living God is making one family of all the earth. And unlike in Henry V, where the king says, if you will shed your blood, you can be part of my family, what we know is because the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords has shed his blood, we've been made into a family. And now we're called to live into that identity, to share life together, to struggle and sacrifice together, to bear one another's burdens, and to each bear our own load. Those sound like contradictions, but they are, in fact, the two sides of the reality coin that is underneath all of our relationships. And what Paul wants us to know is when we live that way, when we bear our own load and when we bear each other's burden, the kingdom of God not only happens to us, it happens through us. And it's not just we who are changed, but the whole world is changed. Paul says that toward the end of the letter. We're in Galatians chapter 5. If you want to open your copy of the scripture there, we're in verse 24. Galatians chapter 5, beginning in verse 24. And there the scripture says, "Those who belong to Christ have crucified the sinful nature with its passions and desires. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying one another. Sisters and brothers, if one among you is caught in sin, all of you who are spiritual should restore that person gently. But watch out, or you too may be tempted. Bear one another's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. If anyone thinks he is something when he's nothing, he has deceived himself. So each one of you should test your own actions. Then you can take pride in yourself without comparison to someone else, for each one must bear their own load." This is the word of the Lord. Paul calls us brothers and sisters because the one true and living God has made us into one family. That's been his theme, that God has made us into a family. Think about what life is like inside a family. The good news is it's not lonely. And the bad news is it's not private. There are people who see you all the time. It is life lived together. And when people live in close quarters with you, they see you in a way that nobody else does. The danger of living in a family is we will give the best of ourselves to the people who matter the least to us. And then when we are tired and spent and we come home, we give the worst of ourselves to our families. It happens to everybody sometimes. And somewhere along the way, it happened in our family, and I don't know if Missy said it or if I said it, but in a particularly bad moment, let's just assume that I was the idiot this time because the odds are that's how it went. And Missy said, "Well, you're stuck with me." And that's become a mantra in our house. It doesn't mean I agree with you or you've done the right thing. "You're stuck with me" means, well, here we are, and neither one of us wants to live the rest of our lives like this, and not anybody's going anywhere, so we might as well work on it. Because we committed a long time ago to never say the word divorce or even think it in our lives. We don't assume that we will always agree, but we've committed to disagree agreeably, but never to dishonor one another. The two sides of the relational reality coin are support and accountability. Someone to say, "That's not who you are. It's not who you want to be. It's not what you want to live into." And both of those are rooted in an understanding that we share a common identity. I'm vested in what you're doing here. And you know we share a common identity because we have the same name. At our house, that name is Wells. We told our children, "When you go out, you represent the Wells family." And we share the same name. Christian. We share God's own name. And when we go out into the world, we represent Him to the world. He says, "Look, you're humans. We're going to get this wrong every so often. If one among you is caught in sin," he doesn't mean if you walked in and got him in the act. He means if somebody's stuck in the cycle of sin, if somebody's trapped in a pattern of sin, somebody who doesn't want to be this way is doing something they ought not be doing, you should restore them gently. That word restore comes from the Greek word for mending fishing nets. Can you imagine Peter and Andrew or James and John there in at the north edge of the Sea of Tiberias in Capernaum? And they're out and they've been fishing all night long. They take those nets they've made and they've been throwing them out by the side of the boat and pulling them back against the pull of the water. And they've been filled with fish and they've strained. And there are places that are frayed. There are holes that have been made where fish are going to get through. And then you don't have anything to feed your family or to sell to take care of yourselves. And so even though you've been out all night long and you're exhausted, when you get back, you clean the fish, and then you lay out the nets, and you start mending them. Not because you want to, but because the nets require it. When he says we have to work for restoration, what he's saying is relationships by their very nature require daily tending. It's the only way for nets to remain operative. It means that relationships require work. That's not a surprise. That's just reality. They take constant tending because they matter to us. Because it's what we put out into the world, trusting something else is going to come back. When someone's caught in a sin, you should restore them gently. Thank you. No, you're right, Cheryl. Thank you. That we know that when it comes for babies and children, right? We have different voices we use when we talk to babies. We know to be gentle with children, but sometimes in the heat of the moment, when we're really excited about something, we forget that we should treat adults that way too. When you're the one who's messed up, don't you want someone to be gentle when they bring it to you? What Paul is saying is that the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control, should guide the way we live in our relationships, should guide the life of the church. At our best, we get that right. Every time we have a wedding at South Main, every time we marry a couple, we say to them, nobody came today thinking you know what you're getting yourself into. We're convinced you're clueless about the commitment that you're making today and it's going to shape the rest of your life. But we came to say we'll be in it with you. And we'll walk with you and pray with you and stand beside you. We're going to dedicate Samuel Silas today and his family. And we're going to say to them, you do not walk this path of parenthood alone. We will walk with you. And their answer is, and we with you. We're not saying y'all are perfect parents and everything's going to be easy. We're not saying we're going to help you prepare the path for the child. We're going to help you prepare your child for the path. And parts of that thing are unpaved. And we know it. But watch yourselves, or you might be tempted to. Paul shifts, by the way, it's hard to see this in English, but he shifts from plural to singular. If someone is caught in sin, all of you ought to restore that person gently, but you, just you, you, be careful, or you might be tempted. All of you watch out, because any of you might fall into the same kind of temptation. And there are two kinds of temptations when we're walking with someone else in their pain and in their sin. The first is that we're tempted to the same thing. Sometimes we speak out most harshly about the sins that are also the sins that we're tempted to commit or we're in the midst of committing. But sometimes the temptation is to pride, because the thing we're walking with someone else through is not the thing that tempts us. And so something in us says, man, I've done some bad things, but I sure haven't done this. As if there is some weighted scale and they have the bad sins and we have the light sins. If that's the way it works, I don't know what the scale is, but I do know this. Jesus died for your sin. And if he had to die for your sin, then we should all have to deal with our sin. That's the way it works. He says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. How beautiful is that? That word bear means to fill up again and again. He says, when you bear the burdens of someone else, you are refilling the work of Jesus in the world. You are replacing the grace of Jesus in the world. Be imitators of Jesus in your own life. And how did Jesus bear your burden? He died on the cross for your sin. So we who bear his name are supposed to be like Jesus. We bear the burdens of others. To be Christian at its most basic is to come alongside people in their suffering, in their pain, in their mistakes, and their sin, and say, let me carry that with you. The name for that kind of living is interdependence. And it's costly. And it's hard. Because interdependence calls us to share. It calls us to share in distress and sorrows. And I will tell you, the church is good at this. If someone you love dies, we're going to show up. If you let us know when things have gone wrong, the church will be there. Chicken casserole is code for I love you and we're not going anywhere. And I will tell you this, there is more grace in this place then there is pain in your life. And if you will let us know when things have gone afoul, the church will come to walk alongside you in ways that nothing else will. I've told you this story before. It's one of my favorite. Addie Carpenter was invited to become a volunteer at the Houston Zoo. Addie knows a ton about elephants. The zoo doesn't let anybody near the elephants, but she had a tour out there, and they were so impressed with her. And they said, Addie, come volunteer. And she turned them down. Well, I knew some people at the zoo, and they called me and said, did we offend her? Did we do something wrong? And I said, I don't know. I'll find out. So I called Addie, and I said, Addie, did you go take a tour at the zoo? She said, I did. Was it a good tour? It was amazing. They do such great work with elephants. I said, I understand they invited you to volunteer with the elephants. She said, they did. I said, I understand you said no. She said, I did. I said, why'd you do that? She said, I learned a long time ago if something goes wrong in my life, the zoo is not going to show up. Y'all, that's wisdom. She said, so nothing's really wrong right now, but until it is, I'm going to come to mainstreamers, and I'm going to come to smile, and I'm going to come to Bible study, and I'm going to come to worship, and I'm going to invest my life in the church because I know if everything goes wrong, the church is going to show up in my life, and I'm going to be church for somebody else until it happens in my life. That's the way it's supposed to work. The church is hard because interdependence calls us to share our lives in mutual correction and accountability. Paul says in Ephesians 5, submit yourselves one to another as an expression of your worship for Jesus Christ. Now, your translation says, submit yourselves to one another as in reverence to Christ. But we could say as an expression of your worship. That is to say, we choose to hear one another and we choose to heed each other's counsel. When we've walked with each other in glad days and sad days alike, when our relationships have become strong and deep, and you have 2 a.m. friends, then we listen to them. And when their counsel is different than our counsel, we know they're telling us something we need to hear. When you form relationships that way, it changes your life. When I was in seminary, one of my professors, Bill Treadwell, said, if you have 5 real friends in your lifetime, you're a rich person. I have to tell you, among the great joys of my life, I married my best friend, and I work with a group of friends. Susan and Matt and Dolores and Adam and Greg and Brad. We celebrate together, and I listen to their counsel, and they offer correction and rebuke and admonition to me when I need it. We seek commiseration when things have gone wrong. But you have to make the choice to let friends in that way. And you could say, sure, you work at the church. Well, yeah, but we also work on all of those relationships. I promise you, you can go to a lot of churches that don't have that kind of interdependence among their ministers. And guess what? You come to the church. And you, there's no reason for you not to be in a Sunday school class or in the choir or in some mission activity of the church where you find deep and abiding friendships that open your life to new vistas of grace and new levels of accountability and correction. Interdependence is hard because it invites us to share our lives financially. Where else does that happen in your life? When you come to the church, we're not going to ask you to sell wrapping paper, and we're not going to ask you to buy an auction item, and you don't have to go to the gala. But every month, as a part of the regular pattern of just living our lives, each of us is called to take the money that we've earned out in the world and trust it to each other. We put it in offering plates and we auto-draft it. And we give it to the Lord through His church, trusting that God is going to do more through all of us than He does through any of us. And who else does that? There's a deep humility in making the decision to live our lives with other people in this way. And it means that we have to admit that we have need. And it means that we'll find out that we know we cannot live alone. We need other people to walk with us and help us. There's also a deep comfort in living this way. And it is, we know we'll never be alone. There's someone to walk with us in the glad days and the sad days alike. Paul says, and this is important, when you're living, test your own actions. That's important because the world constantly invites us to compare our lives to the lives of other people around us. And how do we fare in those comparisons when we do that? Not well. Just take a minute. Everybody else is doing it. It's okay. Look around and just compare your life to anybody else in the room. Think about the stuff you're going through that they're not going through. Think about the resource that they have to meet the challenges that you don't have. I promise you, if you look to the side and compare your life to somebody else, it will not come out well. Their marriage is easy. Their job is secure. Their pathway is straight. There's a slight decline on the marathon they're running all the time. You know why that is? Because you don't know everything that they're going through. But when we look to the side, we invite sorrow and envy and bitterness and frustration to come into our lives because we don't know. If that's not what you want, if you would rather have joy, can I tell you how to get that? Don't look over. Look up. Here's the way you get there. Think about what you have in your life today that's good. Think about the blessing that is in your life right now. And then think back to 6 months before you were born. And tell me what you did to deserve being born. Nothing. Birth is grace. It means everything in life is windfall. It means every blessing in your life today came from the gracious hand of God. And if we could learn to live our lives in front of the audience of one, if we could learn to live our lives in terms of God's grace, if we could just say, God, I know all that I have is yours, and that what you've trusted to me for my good, and so that I can partner with you in redeeming the whole world, then I think a lot of the defensiveness and bitterness and envy and frustration and rivalry in our lives would just go away. For each one of you should bear your own load. And this is the paradox of Christian living. Bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ, and each one of you should bear your own load. Bearing burdens is balanced by bearing our own load. And when we actually live that way, we discover there is enough. John Claypool used to tell a story. There was a farmer who had two sons. And when he died, he split the farm evenly between them. And they continued to work the farm together just as they'd done all of their days. And every year at the harvest, they split the harvest evenly in two. And as time went on, one of the brothers got married and had several children, and the other brother remained single. And one year after the harvest, the single brother was sitting at home alone, and he thought to himself, "I have more than I need. And my brother has so many needs. He has so many mouths to feed, and I just have myself. But I know my brother. He's proud, and he'd never take more than his share of the harvest, but he needs more. So I know what I'll do. Tonight, after everyone's gone to bed, I'm going to go down to my barn, and I'm going to fill my wagon with grain from my barn, and I'm going to take it, and I'm going to put my grain in my brother's barn, and there'll be enough for him." Well, that same night, the other brother was sitting at home, and he thought to himself, "Man, I have more than I need. And when I'm old, I have all of these children to take care of me from in my age, but my brother only has himself. But I know him. He's proud, and he'd never take more than his share of the harvest, so I know what I'll do. Tonight, after everyone's gone to bed, I'm going to go down to my barn, and I'm going to fill my wagon with grain, and I'm going to take my grain, and I'm going to put it in my brother's barn, and then he'll have enough." Well, you know how it went. Under a full moon that night, two brothers with two wagons filled with grain met on the road between their houses. And each of them climbed down from the wagons, and as they walked to each other, each realized what the other was doing, and they began to embrace there in the moonlight. And Claypool said, a gentle rain began to fall that night, as God himself wept from heaven that two of his children finally got it. When we bear our own load, and when we bear each other's burdens, there is enough. There is enough. There is grace.